Atlanta area, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Thanks to the friends of WILL, we have managed to raise this year more than $725,000. I got too many numbers here. $725,000 in support of WILL Radio. That's what we have raised this year. However, we are still about $125,000 short of the money that we will need to purchase and broadcast programs when our new fiscal year begins on the 1st of July. Your contribution made before June 30th can help us soften the impact of continuing reductions in federal, state, and university funding. If you use your credit card, your contribution will definitely be in the bank by June 30th. You can call 217-244-9455 right now or contribute online. Go to our website. It's WILL.UIUC.edu. And we thank you very much. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. And in this part of the program, we will review some recent events in China. We will try to touch on a number of subjects, including relations between China and its neighbors, Japan, Taiwan, and India. We'll also talk a bit about China as a growing political and economic force on the world stage and try to take a look at what that means for daily life in China. And our guest for the program in this hour is Richard Baum. He's director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he is also professor of political science. He specializes in the study of contemporary Chinese politics and foreign relations. He has lived and lectured extensively throughout China and Asia. He's written and edited 8 books and many, many more articles. His current research projects focus on the domestic political consequences of China's increasing global interdependence and also the prospects for war and peace in the Taiwan Strait. He's been a frequent commentator on Chinese and East Asian politics for several major newspapers, also for the BBC, Voice of America, CNN International, and National Public Radio. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask is that people try to be brief so we can keep our program moving and get in as many as possible. But your call is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that we can that you can hear us, that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Baum, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Pleasure.
We appreciate it. There are a number of things I wanted to talk about, and actually something, and this is an event that goes back a few months, goes back nearly to the beginning of the year, but I wanted to ask about it as a way of talking a little bit about how people in China feel about where they are now, particularly in regard to what happened at Tiananmen. Now, how many years ago? We just passed an anniversary.
16th anniversary.
16th anniversary. And the thing that I'm thinking of is the death of Zhao Ziyang,
yes.
Chinese leader who came out to sort of make a stand against the use of violence against the protesters there in Tiananmen and was purged for it and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. He died, and there was a very interesting sort of struggle between the government and Zhao Ziyang's family about what sort of commemoration there would be. And I think that grudgingly at the end, the government kind of gave in and that there was a ceremony. And while he was criticized, it perhaps was a little bit more mild than it might have been. I'm interested in what you can say about what Chinese people would have thought about Zhao Ziyang, and does that give you some opportunity then to say some things about how people today feel about what happened 16 years ago?
It's a very complex question, David, and you're right that the way they treated Zhao Ziyang after his death is indicative of some continuing serious problems of reconciling what happened 16 years ago. The government, I think, was damned if they did and damned if they didn't when Zhao Ziyang died. They've been neglecting him for so long, and indeed they've tried to sweep the entire Tiananmen episode under the rug that his death inevitably called attention once again to what happened 16 years ago and the possible and probable culpability of the Chinese government in creating the outcome that was so disastrous. So when he died, the government, on the one hand, if they had ignored it altogether, they probably would have irritated large numbers of people who still have feelings of frustration and anger about how the whole episode was treated. On the other hand, if they were too effusive in praising him, then they would have encouraged the suggestion that, well, maybe they should issue an apology for how they heaped such abuse on him in the first place. So they had to sort of walk a very fine line between ignoring him and praising him. And I think they did. On the whole, they sort of managed to keep their balance on that line.
Mm-hmm. How do people feel about, when you look at what's happened over the last 16 years, obviously there has been a lot of change, particularly in the economic sphere. How do people think about the lack of change on the political side of things?
Many, many years ago, Deng Xiaoping made a gamble. He bet China's future stability on the proposition that if you reform the economy and give people opportunities to make money, to improve their children's lives, for entrepreneurship, for investment, etc., if you give them market opportunities, they will not demand political participation. And with the exception of Tiananmen, which was a spontaneous eruption of frustration in, not only among students but in the urban society as a whole, his calculus has been pretty, pretty good. China has avoided the kinds of upheavals that resulted in the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union itself. And the big difference between China and these other countries was that China had a decade of rapid, accelerated economic reform, which did indeed improve the livelihoods and life opportunities for at least a substantial number of people, perhaps the majority of people in China. And it did diffuse their political demands.
I think that some people, though, that see these two things, that is... economic change and greater economic freedom as that being connected, inextricably connected with the other.
Right. I think that's correct. And I think what they did was buy time. I think Deng Xiaoping's strategy was good for the short and intermediate term as a palliative. But I think in the long run, economic reform and market relationships themselves breed a demand for greater informational pluralism, social pluralism, economic pluralism, and ultimately political pluralism. It's very difficult to have enable people to make choices for themselves in a market, in a free market, whether it's what to buy, where to go to school, what jobs to take, where to live. Those kinds of choices are now being made by ordinary people in China for the first time in the communist regime. But they still do not have those choices in politics or ideas or even free flow of information. So there is a growing conflict between personal freedom in some spheres and political constraint and ideological constraint in others. So, yes, the tension, the contradictions are growing, and Deng Xiaoping's strategy for buying off political discontent has to be seen, I think, as a short-term palliative. It's not ultimately viable, I don't believe.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Richard Baum, is professor of political science at UCLA, where he is also director of the Center for Chinese Studies. He specializes in studying contemporary Chinese politics and foreign relations. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm fairly certain that in China there can be no public display of political sentiment if the government doesn't approve. And that raises some questions about, again, going back now a couple of months, the kind of demonstrations that took place several places around China to protest Japan. and continuing to demonstrate the continuing feeling of Chinese people that somehow Japan has not, in, at least in their estimation, probably in the estimation of many others, has not fully been accountable for its conduct in elsewhere in Asia during World War II. There seems to be, we seem to be at a time here where the relationship between the governments of China and Japan is, it's quite tense. And in fact, it wasn't very long ago, the vice foreign minister, Wu Dawei of China, said that relations between China and Japan were at their lowest point since there had been relations between China and Japan, in the lowest point in decades. I'm interested in talking about what's going on between the two governments, China and Japan, and also this this wave of sort of popular protest against Japan, where that came from and why it was that the government let it go ahead.
Yeah.
Or whether, in fact, the government could have stopped it if they had wanted to.
Yes. There are a number of interwoven strands that come together in your question, and I'll try to both describe the strands and show how they're interwoven. Number one, there is a great deal of residual historical anger in China at the actions of Japan to begin with during its imperial moment in the first half of the 20th century, and also, secondarily, at the arrogance and lack of accountability for its actions of the current Japanese government. They, ever since 1945, successive Japanese governments have downplayed the costs of their aggression, the brutality of that occupation of China, invasion of China, up to or perhaps more than 10 million civilians were killed. That's bigger than the Holocaust. So there is this residual unhappiness in China, and it can get set off from time to time. Because it's there and because the Japanese government has not done much to assuage it, it is sort of like dry grass waiting to ignite when the proper match comes along. Now, there has been mounting frustration in China on a number of fronts, one of which is the lack of political outlets for free expression. People cannot express themselves freely about their own government, whatever unhappiness they may have. Very difficult to criticize the political system or leaders or policies. And therefore, when an opportunity presents itself to protest almost anything where there is some feeling, some emotion involved, it will generate perhaps more social pressure, more social dynamism than would ordinarily be the case, because there's frustrated lack of expression in so many other areas that in one area where the government says, okay, you can express yourself, you tend to get a more extreme form of expression. So when the Chinese government made it clear that it was going to allow protests against Japan on some seemingly what might be called minor issues, the Japanese premier's visit to a war shrine in Tokyo, the Yasukuni War Shrine, that glorifies, among other things, the leaders of the World War II military machine in Japan. This presented an opportunity for the Chinese government to register its unhappiness. And there have been nationalist forces in Japan that have been increasingly demanding, for example, sovereignty over some disputed islands that lie between Japan and China, the Diaoyutai Islands, or Senkaku Islands, as they call them in Japan. There have been a number of little incidents that have built up, and then the Chinese government decides that they want to register a protest against the Japanese government, and they let it be known that demonstrators will not be resisted. And suddenly you get demonstrations getting out of control. It's not the first time that's happened in China, where something that's ostensibly aimed against Japan builds steam because of other forces that are ignitable or flammable in Chinese society. And then the government has a bit of trouble turning it off once they've turned it on. We saw the same thing happen, for example, when the U.S. embassy, when the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, was bombed by NATO in 1999 by U.S. planes. The Chinese government at first allowed protesters to take to the streets and demonstrate their anger at the U.S. And then, after a while, some of the protests turned against the Chinese government itself, arguing that the Chinese weren't tough enough on the U.S., they didn't demand a pound of flesh, they wimped out at the last minute, and suddenly the Chinese government is presented with a problem that it didn't have before. And I think some of that same dynamic is at play in this current anti-Japanese or recent anti-Japanese demonstrations. There's an underlying dissatisfaction that can turn against the Chinese government if they let it get out of control.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that struck me was, in reading about this, was that the demonstrators, the people who were involved in this, seemed to be young people and people who would have been born long after World War II, where certainly they would have been, they could well have learned in school about what the Chinese, what the Japanese did in China and in Korea. But one wondered whether they would have had much in the way of a personal connection to
well,
the, to
you shouldn't underestimate that residual anger at Japan. I've seen it happen in very sort of odd occasions in China when you wouldn't expect it to happen. People of all ages, younger and older, displaying deep emotions about what happened in World War II. Again, you know, the magnitude of the Japanese death toll in China was extraordinary, and they experimented with chemical weapons on Chinese prisoners. I mean, there was some really serious, horrible stuff that went on, and it's never been accounted for. Unlike the Nazis' behavior in Germany, the Japanese have really not come to grips with their own past, and I think it does fuel great Chinese resentment.
And for all of that, though, I have, in some of what I've read about this, suggest that, yes, indeed, these feelings about the past history between the two countries do play a role here, and they're something that you
right.
cannot ignore. And yet, at the same time, you also have to pay attention to the fact that here we have two countries that are vying for
right.
For economic and political dominance
sure.
in Asia and in the world.
Sure. I think the dawning contradiction in Northeast Asia is the inevitable clash of interests between Japan and China. We often forget about Japan when we think about our own difficult relationship with China. I think the Japanese are having a very rocky relationship, and I think that one has lots of potential to get worse before it gets better.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start with someone listening this morning in Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello, David. I'd like your guest to comment on to what extent and what manner that the Chinese economy and society will falter because it is a highly totalitarian regime, and it would never have allowed two bicycle manufacturers to work on a newfangled thing called an airplane. But, of course, this was exactly what was needed when the Wright brothers did their invention.
I think the question goes to the issue of competition. And since the Chinese government is a one-party authoritarian regime that does not allow competition in the political sphere, does that threaten the economic growth in the sense that competition is also discouraged there? Thus far, the Chinese have really done a good job of creating a watertight compartment for their economy, allowing competition into the economy, reforming the old ossified state-owned enterprises that were so inefficient and couldn't compete in the external world. Deng Xiaoping, I think, did a very smart thing when he opened China's economy to the outside world, because that meant the Chinese firms would have to either shape up and become competitive with the best international producers, or would be swept aside as China opened its doors and reduced its tariffs and so on. And China's membership in the WTO has further opened Chinese markets to foreign competition, so that competition is now the rule, not the exception, in the domestic economy. It's certainly still true that there's no competition in the political sphere, and that particular contradiction will probably come back to haunt the Chinese leadership at some point. But thus far, 9-10% economic growth every year has managed to assuage a lot of political frustration. As long as you give unemployed workers the hope that they might get jobs in the future, or that their children might have better prospects than they had, you can keep political criticism and political demands down to a minimum. And thus far, it's worked as a strategy. But if the economy falters, if global demand for Chinese manufacturers should diminish, a drop suddenly, with a global contraction in demand, this would leave China very, very vulnerable to political pressures. And one might then see some increasing signs of social and political unrest in China.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here locally in Champaign-Urbana. This is Line 1. Hello.
Yes, hello. Interesting. Another financial question. There was a news story that with the title, "Which Chinese Owns Your," meaning in the West,
yes,
"Your Mortgage?" And it seems a little research suggests it's not individuals, but like governments holding paper, bonds, and so forth. But the oil is priced in dollars and has been going up, at least in dollars. So comments would be appreciated on why they might hold such a large amount of dollars and what would happen if the dollar depreciates.
Yes, well, the Chinese, as you know, are their balance of trade is favorable and has been for some years. They have built up a surplus in their U.S. dollar accounts. They have chosen to put their surplus into U.S. dollars because it has been for many decades the world's stablest, most reliable currency. In the meantime, the U.S. government has built up increasing national debt, and the Chinese, it turns out, are financing our profligacy as a nation. The Bush administration and others, manufacturers and labor unions, point to the fact that the Chinese are taking jobs. But really, the dominant phenomenon that's going on in terms of international finance and economy is that the Chinese are financing our unbridled habits of consumption. And it's a little hard to critique them for that, because if they didn't, or somebody else didn't, then we wouldn't be able to spend the way we're spending now. So there's some real contradictions. Some economists have estimated that even if we cut China's textile imports and put quotas or tariffs on some of the products that are flooding into American markets, it really wouldn't make that much difference in American jobs. That most of the jobs are being lost to technological high costs of producing goods in America, and China isn't the only country where low-cost alternatives are available, and therefore the Chinese factor is really just a symptom of this growing technology sophistication ladder, where people are still working in third world countries at low wages but are using increasingly sophisticated technology, often provided by American firms. You know, most of Chinese exports, what is again not widely known, most Chinese exports to the American market come from American-owned or foreign-owned firms. They're not Chinese-owned. They're owned by foreigners. So we're importing products that are produced by companies owned by our own citizens or our own corporations. It's not always, indeed, not even usually, the Chinese who are flooding our markets.
We are at our midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Other questions would be certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you might hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Even if you were listening on the Internet, as long as you were in the United States, you could use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And I'd like to, again, introduce our guest, Richard Baum. He's professor of political science at University of California, Los Angeles, where he's also director of the Center for Chinese Studies. He specializes in the study of contemporary Chinese politics and foreign relations. He's written a number of books and many more articles, and is a frequent commentator on Chinese and East Asian politics for several major newspapers, as well as the BBC, CNN, Voice of America, National Public Radio. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. One thing I'd like to have you talk a little bit about is and I know it's a particular interest of yours, is the relationship between, or the tensions between, maybe a better word to use, China and Taiwan. Something interesting happened not very long ago. The leader of the opposition, the political opposition in Taiwan, the Kuomintang, came and visited China. This was Liangshan, and he met with the president of China, Hu Jintao, although he was not meeting with him as the president. He was apparently meeting with him as the chief of the Communist Party. So it was not a governmental deal formally. This is the first time the party leaders had met since the nationalists lost the civil war and left in 1949. So this seems to be, to me at least, to be a pretty significant event. And now I don't know how much of this was just intended to be kind of a snub to the current government of Taiwan, but just how significant a meeting was this?
Well, the fact that Lien John would spite his own government by jumping across the Taiwan Straits to visit Beijing is indicative of the high political temperature of politics in Taiwan itself. The conflict between the ruling DPP, Democratic Progressive Party, of President Chen Shui-bian, which is a pro-independence party, which has been constantly pushing toward greater autonomy, greater sovereignty, greater independence, to the point where a couple of years ago President Bush warned them to cut it out, not to try to change the situation unilaterally, because it has the possibility of dragging the United States into a war in the Taiwan Straits that it does not want. So the DPP, the ruling party, has been pushing the independence envelope, and the opposition party, Lien John, heads the Kuomintang, which used to be the ruling party until it was unseated by election some years ago. The opposition party still feels that it was denied its legitimate fruits of victory a year ago when, in a presidential election that looked like it was going to result in a Kuomintang victory, Lien John was ahead in the polls until less than 24 hours ahead of the election. And then an assassin stray bullet wounded the president, created a groundswell of sympathy for Chen Shui-bian. And on election day, suddenly, the Kuomintang lost the election. I think there was an enormous amount of bitterness and resentment among the Kuomintang supporters at that outcome. And I think what's happened in the last year is partly a result of that residual bitterness over the stolen, what has been called at least a stolen election. When Lien John was running for president a year ago, he campaigned, among other things, on a platform that if elected, he would go to China and try to make some kind of peace, try to restart stalled negotiations across the Taiwan Straits. Well, he lost the election, but guess what? The Chinese, in their own sort of divide-and-conquer strategy, decided it might be a good idea to invite the opposition leader to create some tension and problems in Taiwan, because it was known that the Democratic Progressive Party would resist such a move, would oppose it. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. Lien John went to China. He spoke of the long association between the Kuomintang and the Chinese, the "we are all Chinese" kind of feeling that he imparted. And it didn't play well with the DPP, with the government, and they've been denouncing him. And also another rival politician, opposition politician, James Sung, who headed the next largest political party, the People's First Party in China, in Taiwan. He also visited China shortly after Lien John. So there's been this groundswell of opposition visiting the heartland of the enemy in Beijing and coming away with smiles and goodwill. And this has put some pressure on Chen Shui-bian in Taiwan to do the same, because most Taiwanese people, while they certainly prefer their current status of not being governed by China, there's no doubt that 70 to 80% of the people of Taiwan do not want to reunify with China under current circumstances. Still, they want to avoid a war, and they see the fruitfulness of the Lien John's visit, of James Sung's visit, and they're asking, well, why is Chen continuing to push the envelope toward a confrontation with China? So there is now a great deal of pressure on Chen Shui-bian to take some kind of conciliatory moves toward China. And in that sense, the Chinese strategy seems to be bearing fruit.
Well, going some years back, I had a friend who had grown up in Taiwan, and she said when she was a little girl, there still was, at least what they were taught in school, still was this story that one of these days we're going to go and we're going to take China back.
Yeah.
And this was still at the time when there was actually a government on Taiwan, there was a government in absentia. There was this enormous legislature of people who ostensibly represented places back in China.
Yes, they were elected in 1947.
And this idea was that, and people did indeed, whether they believed it, the formal state philosophy, the idea was any day now, we're going to go back. Well, we're long past that. That's done. But I still do find myself wondering, well, for your average person in Taiwan, what do they think about how they're going to sort this out? Because there still continue to be important cultural ties and ties of blood that just aren't going to go away. What's the long-term potential for getting some kind of relationship, a more peaceful and productive relationship worked out between Taiwan and mainland China, the Republic of China?
Well, you're certainly right that the old fiction, the old myth about returning to the mainland and recovering all of China for the Kuomintang has long since died. It, officially, it died a little over a decade ago. The Kuomintang renounced its claim to sovereignty over all of China. But they still have the name Republic of China. And, of course, that's one of the big sticking points. The Chinese on the mainland say there is only one China, and Taiwan is a part of China. And the current Taiwanese government says, no, we're not. We are Taiwanese. Now, there are some residual historical issues here, too, because the government on Taiwan, the Republic of China government on Taiwan, was installed in 1949 by the losing side in the Chinese Civil War, the Kuomintang, which retreated under Chiang Kai-shek to Taiwan after having lost its military campaign. About 3 million mainlanders accompanied Chiang Kai-shek from China back to Taiwan, and they became a ruling minority, dominating, monopolizing political power for decades. And this created resentment with the native Taiwan population. Now, the native population of at that time about 15 or 16 million, plus the 3 million late-coming Chinese in 1949, comprised about 20 million, a population of 20 million. 16 million or more of whom were born on Taiwan, in Taiwan. Now, they had Chinese ancestors for the most part, but those ancestors went back to the 19th century and earlier, since Japan had ruled Taiwan since 1895 until the end of World War II. It was not a Chinese territory. So there was a break of over 50 years in Chinese relationship with Taiwan. And in those 50 years, many Taiwanese took on a sort of local coloration. They became more Taiwanese than Chinese. They began to speak the local dialect. The children learned local dialect. And now, flash forward to the early 21st century, whenever a politician goes on a stump in an election in China, they have to speak Taiwanese. Every viable national candidate for office in Taiwan must speak the local dialect, because otherwise he would be perceived as a carpetbagger, as a latecomer, and there is some resentment against those carpetbaggers. So the independence people, the Chen Shui-bian and the DPP, play upon the resentment of the indigenous majority of Taiwanese people against the carpetbagging monopoly of the old Kuomintang, and that's been one of their strongest electoral cards in the last decade or more. So there's very complex politics going on in Taiwan.
Let us talk with another caller here, and we have someone listening in Eureka. We'll go there, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting discussion, David. Your previous discussion about corporations was along the line that I was interested in. I've heard from various sources, I believe one on David's program and another on the Frontline documentary about Walmart, that anywhere between 70% to 80% of the products sold at Walmart have at least some of their components made in China. Do you know if that's true, and could you comment a little bit about Walmart's relationship to China, please?
Yeah, Walmart employs more people in China than anywhere else in the world. I think 80% of their workforce, tens of thousands, I don't have the exact figures, but tens of thousands of people work for Walmart-owned companies in China, Walmart producers. So it is a major economic force in China. And there has been, as you know, a good deal of criticism that Walmart is bottom fishing in China, that they're encouraging low wages, that they're encouraging poor working conditions, or at least tolerating, if not encouraging, and costing American jobs. Of course, Walmart is quite unpopular in some circles in the U.S. for its employment practices here, not just in China. Mm. So this is a major economic issue. The very size of Walmart, just as the very size of China, you know, size matters in countries as well as in export trade. And Walmart has been able to dictate to its Chinese suppliers the conditions of trade, and that's very worrisome to some people.
Did you say that Walmart was the biggest American employer in China? Is that what you meant? Maybe I understood you wrong.
Let me think. It is certainly the biggest American employer. Whether it's the biggest employer altogether, I mean, apart from the Chinese government, which employs millions of workers in the state sector, it may be the biggest single payroll signer, check signer in China outside of the Chinese government. That I can't vouch for, but it sounds right.
Could I ask one more question, David?
Sure.
I guess we keep hearing China is the world's largest country in population. Is it true now China is... has one-fifth of the total population of the world?
That's been roughly true for the last 40 or 50 years, although, according to current demographic projections, India may surpass China sometime in the next couple of decades, because China has an effective population control policy, and India does not.
The one-parent, one-child-per-family policy then has been working to a great
extent. It's one-plus. There have been enough exceptions to the one-child policy and enough fudging of the one-child policy, particularly now in a market economy when people have alternative sources of income, and the prospect of a sanction, a state-imposed economic sanction, isn't quite as devastating as it was two decades ago, because now you can afford to put your kids in private school or buy a private house. You don't have to rely on your workplace for housing and health and schooling. So now people are freer to simply avoid central policy and pay the consequences if there's a fine or a sanction. So you're having more and more families, particularly rural families, with two children. Urban families seem to be self-regulating. That is, when you have two income earners in a competitive economy, they don't want to have a lot of kids. Education is becoming increasingly expensive in China. It's a real burden for most Chinese families, so they're voluntarily limiting the size of families. And indeed, in a city like Shanghai, their current birth rate is not even going to sustain the existing population. It is not reproducing the existing population.
So, my goodness, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go on to another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes. Do you care to comment on the different ways that the people on Taiwan and the people on mainland have tried to modify traditional Chinese culture in the interests of modernization and some form of representative government?
That's an interesting question. Let me start with the mainland. Of course, during the Maoist period, traditional Chinese culture was strongly opposed as reactionary, feudal, and in the Cultural Revolution, Red Guards were not only allowed but encouraged to destroy the four olds, old customs, old habits, old culture, and old ideology, and they smashed temples, and they ransacked museums, and they did all kinds of destructive acts. In the reform period, starting with Deng Xiaoping and then continuing under Jiang Zemin and now Hu Jintao, there's been a much greater respect for Chinese tradition, not least because it may offer a solution to the diminishing ideological legitimacy of the regime. Since communism no longer inspires people in China, the current governing leadership has been looking for an alternative, and thus far the only thing that's emerged as a sort of strong enough mobilizing force is nationalism, which we talked about earlier as a two-edged sword. So the Chinese government has to be a little nervous about using nationalism to gain popular support and enthusiasm. One alternative that they are now looking at seriously is a revival of Confucianism as a state ideology. They're now talking about building a harmonious society. That's a mantra that we've heard over and over again the last 6 to 8 months in China. What does it mean? It means harmonizing conflicting interests. Instead of having interest groups that fight out for their interests in a public domain with interest groups, political parties, elections, you instead try to find the commonality, the consensual point between conflicting interests, and you harmonize them in some metaphysical way, almost. It doesn't really say how that's to be achieved. But it is redolent of what they call Neo-Confucianism, which was the ideology of state in the 17th through 19th centuries, when the Chinese government sold its notion of a harmonious society to the peasants below. It's an interesting, curious reversion to an earlier sense of organic unity between rulers and ruled. I'm not sure it's going to be effective because it really doesn't allow voices for distinctive interests to compete in the battlefield of politics. It's a substitute for pluralistic politics. And in that sense, I don't think it's going to provide a long-term solution to their problems.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Richard Baum. He's professor of political science at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, where he's also director of the Center for Chinese Studies. He specializes in studying contemporary China, its politics, and foreign relations. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We're talking about the fact just how energized and how booming the Chinese economy has been in recent years, and it's particularly affected coastal China and cities like Shanghai that are real boom towns. This kind of prosperity, however, has not all Chinese people have shared in this, and apparently for people who live in rural areas, there are some places in China we might go where in many important respects life has not changed in a long time, where people are probably living the way they have lived there going back certainly hundreds of years probably, and maybe even longer than that. Just how significant is this kind of gap in development and economic well-being between the part of China that's booming and the rest?
One of the phenomena that's most alarming to Chinese economists and political forecasters is the increasing polarization of wealth in China. There's no doubt that since the reform began, the rich are getting richer and the poor are not. Whether they're getting poorer is another question. I'm not sure they're getting poorer, but they're certainly not getting much richer. So there is a widening gap. It's both a rural-urban gap, with the city's average income increasing much faster than rural areas. It's also a coastal, as you indicated, a coastal interior gap, with the special economic zones along the eastern seaboard from Guangdong province and the special zones Shenzhen and Xiamen and Fujian, all the way up to Shanghai in the east coast. These cities now have average per capita income of a couple of thousand U.S. dollars, sometimes more. Shanghai now has an average per capita income that is 10 times higher than the poorest Chinese province of Guizhou. So this gap is serious. A couple of years ago, I brought a group of my UCLA students to the interior of China, to Qinghai province in the northwest, one of the poorest. And my students taught English to high school kids in a village that, as you indicated in your question, David, was sometimes seemed like it was from another, if not century, then certainly several decades ago. There was no electricity in these villages. There was no running water. They were dirt poor with an average per capita cash income of $100 a year. Development has come very slowly and with great difficulty to these interior areas of China. So while most of us focus on the Shanghais and Beijings and Cantons of the world as an indicator of China's successful development, there is a vast hinterland that is not doing so well. And the Chinese government knows that. They're conscious of the growing gap. They're worried about it for political reasons. And they are trying to redirect resources. For the last few years, they've had a program called the Western Development Program, which has tried to earmark large amounts of state investment for infrastructure projects in the less advantaged areas of the interior and rural China. Roads, highways, airports, trains, tracks, new cities. The whole damming of the Yangtze, upper level reaches of the Yangtze River, is part of this strategy to bring commerce and transportation to the interior parts of China. And I think to some extent, that's working. You have to sort of link the people of the western half of the country. It's a vast country. It's the same size as the United States, but two-thirds of the population live on the eastern part of that country. Only one-third live in this vast western expanse that occupies hundreds of thousands of square miles. And the attempt to bring the western parts of the country into closer, more frequent contact with the booming eastern part of the country, is a development strategy that I think will bear fruit. It's a question of making investment possible, of bringing markets closer, of bringing the benefits of high technology to the interior. It's slowly happening. It's not happening overnight. But I do believe it will happen. And I think eventually the rising tide of the Chinese economy will start floating some of these rural interior boats. Mm. But it's taking a long time in the process, and it's worrisome to the Chinese.
We have some other callers. We'll try to get at least one in the time that remains. This is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. First of all, I wanted to ask about at least my perception about China wanting to be able to criticize other governments or Japan, et cetera, or the United States for what they perceive as wrongs done by those governments, but why there is a lack of responsibility or even dialogue about such things as their history with Tibet. I even talked to a Chinese gentleman who actually even denies that there were killings of Tibetan people and monks, etc. And then second of all, also in my, at least in dialogue with people that have come from mainland, that there is a value system put on those that are educated and or have money. And it's almost it seems that they associate those people as being moral and those that are poor as being lazy or beggars, that this seems to be of some importance. And I don't know if that's some type of ideology that is taught, I'm not saying outright, but if that is a main theme in Chinese belief and that the government promotes.
Mm-hmm. Those are two very interesting questions. Let me start with the first one. You're right in observing that the Chinese government won't deal with some of its own internal problems, but is quite free to shake a finger at others. I don't think that's a very surprising tactic. It's called, you know, in football we say the best defense is a good offense. Point out the other guy's weaknesses and you may not have to deal with your own. We do the same thing, by the way. It's not just the Chinese that do it. In fact, the Chinese have been gleeful about some of the revelations about Guantanamo and some of the other problems with U.S. prisoners and human rights violations in connection with the war in Iraq and the war against terrorism, because it tends to take the heat off them for their own human rights practices. So the Chinese have been pointing out our problems of late with some degree of glee. But this is a general problem. All governments do that. As far as the value system, that's a very interesting question, because there is an imperial elitist attitude in China that intellectuals and educated people do tend to see themselves as the inheritors of virtue and wisdom and truth and leadership skills. This is part of and parcel of Confucian stratified society. In Confucian society, the scholar becomes the advisor to emperors and is the font of wisdom. And ordinary people are, perhaps not intentionally, but in the process, they tend to be disdained as hoi polloi, or as they say in Chinese, lao bai xing, the old hundred names, common people. In Tiananmen, in 1989, the students were elitist when they refused, for example, to share leadership of the democracy movement with workers who were protesting undemocratic factory and industrial policies. The workers tried to join with the students, and they weren't given a share of the spotlight. They were forced to have their own headquarters in a remote part of Tiananmen Square, and the students looked down on them. So, yes, this is a kind of ingrained attitude that stems from Confucian values. I think there's people in China who are aware of that and who are trying to counteract it and create a more egalitarian political culture, but it's going to be an uphill struggle, particularly since there is such an educational gap between rural and urban China. Urban Chinese have access to really high-quality education and have, on average, at least a junior high school, in many cases high school education, many college-educated people in urban China. In rural China, the opportunities for educational advancement are extremely limited. And so there is not just an income gap, but also an education gap, which is further contributing to the elitism of some intellectuals in China.
We are going to have to stop there. I'm sorry that we can't continue. There is much more that we could discuss, but for the moment, we'll have to leave it at that because we have used our time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Richard Baum. He's professor of political science at UCLA. He's also director of the Center for Chinese Studies there. Professor Baum, thank you.
It's a pleasure, David.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible today with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer Certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information is available on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. That's just about it for us here at Focus 580. Just a quick reminder that tomorrow morning in the first part of the program, we will talk with Ed Yonka, who is Director of Communications for the American Civil Liberty, ACLU of Illinois. And we'll talk about some of the discussion revolving around the Patriot Act and whether or not it should be renewed. Then in the second hour, we will look back to the life of a man who is to some degree synonymous with political corruption, or at least between ties between politics and business. And we'll talk about the life of the man known as Boss Tweed. Our guest will be Ken Ackerman. He's a writer and attorney and has written a new biography, Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. That's tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our topic, invasive alien species. Alan Burdick, a senior editor for Discover Magazine, will be our guest following the 1 o'clock news. He's the author of the new book, Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. July wheat, 320 and a half, down 2. September, 330 and a quarter, down 2. July corn, 220, down 3 quarters. September, 229, down 3 quarters. December, 238 and a quarter, down 1 quarter. And March corn, 246 and a quarter, down 1 quarter. July beans, 679, up 1 and a quarter. August, 681 and a half, up 1 and a quarter. November beans, 688, up 2. July meal, 214.50, down 70. July oil, 23.39, up 23. August feeder cattle, 113.30, up a nickel. June live cattle, 85 even, down 30. June lean hog, 67.30, down 110. July bellies, 70.95, that 122 and a half lower. July crude,